It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at some of the biggest science news of 2017 with Gemma Tarlack of Discover Magazine.
First, Governor Walker is lifting a sulfide mining moratorium today. In a bill signing ceremony in Rhinelander, Walker repealed a nearly 20-year-old law. The law had barred companies from copper, gold, and other sulfide ore mining if they couldn't meet strict environmental standards.
The legislation passed the Senate and Assembly last month with no Democratic support.
Jason Stein is a Capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's with us for a look at the latest. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be with you.
Let's look at the law that is being signed out of existence today, this mining moratorium. It wasn't a complete and utter ban on this kind of mining, but it was pretty darn close, wasn't it?
Right. I mean, I think it was effectively a ban. It was signed into law in 1998 under then Republican Governor Tommy Thompson, and it basically said that a company would need to prove that a mine had been in operation elsewhere in the country, a similar mine had been in operation, and had not led to pollution during the mining or afterward before a mine could open in Wisconsin.
And now that's gone, we saw pretty much a party-line vote or a close-to-party-line vote in the legislature. Can you talk about some of the pro-con arguments as that moved its way through the legislature?
Right. All Democrats voted against the bill. A handful of Republicans also joined them. The argument that is being made is that this is not your grandfather's mining, that new technology will allow mining to be done safely, and that there are few other industries that have as much potential for bringing jobs to the northern part of the state, or new jobs to the northern part of the state. And then, the arguments against is that, one of the very big important things to the north and Wisconsin in general is tourism and outdoor recreation, and that, our natural environment is, key to that. And, for that reason and many others that, the risk of mining is too great.
And a lot of this has been an argument between two northern Wisconsin legislators, or those are the ones I've seen quoted a lot, Tom Tiffany for the Republicans, Janet Bewley for the Democrats. They've both made those arguments, right, representing their own part of the state.
Correct. I mean, Senator Tiffany, one of his go-to arguments has been to point out that the bill does not actually change environmental standards for a mine in the state. In other words, it certainly sort of removes the moratorium, but doesn't lower the standards that a mine would have to meet to get a state permit. And, on the other side, Senator Bewley has repeatedly said that, well, if we can, if you're so sure that this can be done safely, why don't we just make companies prove it?
Jason Stein is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the end of Wisconsin's so-called mining moratorium law that was signed out of existence by Governor Walker earlier today in Rhinelander. And Jason, are mining companies lining up to get access to these sulfide ores here in Wisconsin?
I mean, that's a good question, but I guess it depends on what you mean by lineup. I mean, certainly there are known deposits of some of these minerals, such as, gold and zinc and so on, in the state, and there's a real possibility that a company might move forward with this. Obviously, at the same time, there's a lot of factors that affect mining, and, we had in 2013 legislation passed to make it easier to do iron mining in Wisconsin. We had a company, Gogebic Taconite, that was interested in doing that. And ultimately, so far at least, no company has really moved forward with iron mining in the state. So, very much remains to be seen. And even if we did see a mine, it's not going to be a today, tomorrow type of arrival.
Historically, Wisconsin has done this kind of mining, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the supporters of the legislation are going to say is that we have a miner on the state flag. It's part of our heritage. Even the Badger State is sort of a reference to miners burrowing in the earth, and that, it would be good to return to that. On the other hand, the opponents of mining say that that's just not where the economy is right now, and that we ought to be chasing technology jobs and jobs of the future, so to speak.
Wisconsin had this mining moratorium, and as you mentioned, it had some bipartisan support signed into law by a Republican governor. Were we unique in the country for having this kind of moratorium in place?
I believe that we were, yes.
And what kind of lobbying was done in favor and against this legislation on the way through?
You know, obviously, it was one of the absolute top priorities both for the environmental lobby and for the business lobby. You know, we saw the creation of, you know, a group to the Natural Resource Development Association as to take a sort of pro-mining stance. I mean, this is, you know, very heavily and intensely debated on both sides. And, you know, don't think for a second that that won't continue. You know, if you were to see a company, you know, file a mining application or even just start exploring mineral deposits in preparation of a potential mine.
And we've had some big battles over the years over mining in Wisconsin. You mentioned the Gogebic Taconite iron mine proposal that didn't end up happening, the Crandon mine proposal. If a sulfide mine, now that the moratorium is gone, if one was proposed in an environmentally sensitive area, this could be a hot controversy in the state.
Absolutely. And, you know, it would likely happen somewhere in northern Wisconsin where we still have a number of Native American tribes. We still have the ability under state law, local governments will still be able, through powers like zoning, to prevent mining from happening in their area under certain circumstances. You know, so there's a lot of, and then obviously there's the state permitting system for a mine that would remain in place. So all sorts of venues where the fight over mining will continue to play out in the state.
And before we let you go, Jason, as you mentioned, the timeline for a mine proposal, there's no way to guess that. But the way this law is written, is it effective as soon as the governor signed it today, or is this phased in over time?
It is effective immediately. However, there is some lag time before this goes into effect, I believe 6 months before it goes completely into effect. And that is in part to allow local governments enough time that they could pass ordinances or other, you know, resolutions preventing mining in their area.
Jason, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jason Stein. He covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us to look at the repeal of Wisconsin's sulfide mining moratorium that was signed today by Governor Walker. Right now, a new review published in the prestigious journal Science is shaking up the timeline of human migration out of Africa. Up until now, the conventional timeline put that at about 60-ish thousand years ago. Now they say there's tons of evidence pointing way, way earlier.
That's one of the top 10 science stories of the year, according to Discover magazine. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover, which is based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, and happy science to you both.
Well, hi. So before we get to the story about human migration, one of the biggest stories in 2017 in science was how the current administration is affecting science. Discover created a timeline about that. Why did you call it Science Under Siege But Surviving?
Well, I think we really wanted to kind of capture the zeitgeist, as it were, for science research, researchers, people who hope to be researchers one day, and also how science is viewed by the current administration. And, you know, it's been a challenging year. There have been a lot of very significant proposed cuts. There have been a lot of rollbacks of science-driven policy. And at the same time, you know, all hope is not lost. If you look at Facebook feeds, sometimes you can feel that people are really distressed over how science is viewed. But the fact is, there's also a lot of promise. A lot more scientists are making their voices heard. And so it's a tough year. It's been a tough year, but there are signs of hope.
So in timeline form, what kinds of events did you include as you went through the last year or so?
Well, you know, of course, on the positive side, we have more than 100,000 people gathered in April in Washington, D.C. for the March for Science. That's an unprecedented number for science. Plus, on all seven continents, you know, people were making their voices heard in sister events. And at the same time, we have other stories, such as rollbacks of executive orders, for example, to make sure that federal properties are protected from climate change, and the actual term climate change falling out of favor and researchers being told you can't say climate change, you need to say extreme weather. And obviously, the big story was in June, the decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Accord, which seeks, of course, to flatline greenhouse emissions by 2050. That is huge for people who take climate change seriously, because it is a serious thing.
So we are in this new administration, and it feels as though sometimes we're getting a lot of news out there. And I think we sometimes don't necessarily think of an overlap between science and politics, not saying that it isn't there. So how has Discover navigated our current political climate and how it is affecting the science world?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is not a new territory for us. For example, in last year's Year in Science review, we talked about how Brexit was going to affect researchers. And it's not just affecting individual researchers in terms of possibly having to leave the country where they're doing their research, but also, you know, there are all these projects, all these collaborations that were thrown into jeopardy by Brexit. So it's not unusual for us to cover politics when it impacts science. And so it was very important to us to just give our readers the information, and as, you know, objectively as we could. And we have no interest in wading into the political waters out there. And so we just wanted to remind people that there has been this series of decisions that is going to directly affect and is already affecting how research is done, how research is funded, how research results are viewed. And we think that's very important.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. We're starting our look at some of the big stories in science of 2017. We'll pick that up also next week at about this time. And Gemma, a story we've talked about in bits and pieces with you, and now it's starting to come together. We're changing the timeline, staying with timelines of when modern-ish humans started to spread around the world. A big article, big review of what's out there in the journal Science. What's going on?
Yeah, and you know, that's, it's interesting because this big review came out last Thursday in Science saying we have to really rewrite the human migration story. I learned in school, and probably you guys did as well, that the species Homo sapiens evolved probably around 200,000 years ago, evolved into modern humans about 100,000 years ago in Africa, and then left Africa about 50,000 years ago. All of that this year has been thrown by the wayside. And even though Science came out, as I said, last Thursday with this big story saying, hey, it's time to rewrite the timeline, I've been seeing these other stories just pop all year, thinking, oh my gosh, this is the year when they're going to rewrite the timeline. and sure enough, you know, they did. Obviously, our magazine was already at the publisher by the time Science printed their big review, but we do have in our Year in Science issue just kind of an overview of all these different studies that it now appears that our species evolved twice as long ago as we thought. We already have fossils from about 300,000 years ago that from Morocco that show Homo sapiens were around much earlier than we thought. And the amount of evidence we have outside of Africa that shows our species had moved outside of Africa much earlier than we thought, it really reached a tipping point this year. And so the researchers are finally moving towards a new consensus that Homo sapiens evolved 300,000 to 400,000 years ago and began leaving Africa more than 100,000 years ago in various waves. So there were multiple waves rather than just one huge migration out of Africa.
So this is a big history to look back on, 300,000 years. What does this mean for, I guess, what we think of as, I guess, paleoanthropology? How might it change in the coming decades?
Well, you know, that's always the question, like, what is the next fossil just right under the surface waiting to be discovered? And I think one of the great things about this new consensus shift is for decades, there were paleoanthropologists very senior in their field who kind of, you know, laid down the law like, no, this is the story. Homo sapiens are no older than 200,000 years, and they never left Africa before 50 or 60,000 years ago. And now finally, I think what we're seeing here in this shift, this call to rewrite the timeline, is really that the field as a whole is saying, okay, guys, let's face it. The evidence no longer supports that model. And what I think it does, it frees paleoanthropologists now, as they find new things, to come up with new models and new ideas. They're not so kind of stuck in the old way of thinking.
And part of the story here is, as I understand it, the interaction between what we would call modern humans and some of the other offshoots on our family tree, some of the predecessors of humans, Homo erectus, the Denisovians? Am I saying that one right?
Denisovans.
There you go. There were like different permutations of human-ish people out there. So what are we starting to learn about how we got along with them?
Well, in terms of the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, they are other members of the Homo genus that were around at about the same time we were, more or less. And what we're finding is that we knew there was episodes of interbreeding with our species and the Neanderthals, with the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, with the Denisovans and us. I mean, let's face it, you know, when humans get together, stuff happens. And what they're finding now is that it is also going much further back in time. There was a paper out this summer that found that a Homo sapiens woman actually contributed mitochondrial DNA, that's the maternally inherited DNA, she actually contributed that to the Neanderthal gene pool as long ago as 470,000 years ago. So obviously, that means Homo sapiens are older than we thought, and they were meeting Neanderthals a lot earlier than we thought. That's just one paper, and it's just looking at genetic evidence from one fossil. So it's not quite, we're not quite ready for a consensus shift on that particular point, but we are finding, like I said, all this evidence that we were around earlier in time, and we were around earlier in geography in terms of how far Homo sapiens traveled early.
So there's also not necessarily an alternative timeline, but there are some theories that maybe Homo sapiens evolved kind of where they were regionally. You go a little bit into depth in your article about that. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, sure. You know, for years, again, this general consensus model that is falling by the wayside now, it held that Homo sapiens evolved in Africa. And then once we were fully modern Homo sapiens, we left Africa. And that's been the general model. And at the same time, there has been a smaller group of researchers arguing for something called the regional continuity model. And they believe that Homo erectus, who was around 2 million years ago, way before we were, Homo erectus evolved in Africa and then left Africa. And we do have a handful of sites. There's one in the Republic of Georgia and the Caucasus. There's more in Asia. There are a few sites that show Homo erectus did reach way far out of Africa. And these populations of Homo erectus, they were successful in their little areas, in their little territories, whether it be in China or in Georgia or in other places. They lived there. They evolved. And then when these modern Homo sapiens came out of Africa, whenever that happened, they interbred with these already established populations. So the regional continuity model is not that all modern Homo sapiens came from Africa, but that populations that we see, say, in China or in, for example, again, Central Asia, some of these populations are actually rooted in archaic Homo erectus populations that were there all the time, that never left these places, but then interbred with Homo sapiens later. So it's kind of a fine gradation in the different models in some ways, but basically the regional continuity model is now gaining a lot of interest as we find more and more fossils that suggest this might be a thing.
Well, Gemma, I like this story as an example of how science works. We've got a model in place based on the best information we had. A piece of information, a piece of evidence comes along that contradicts it. maybe you doubt the evidence. Another piece, well, you might doubt that. But at some point, you hit this tipping point where there's enough evidence where you have to go back and say, hey, maybe that model isn't quite right after all.
Exactly. I mean, that's the scientific method in work, that you come up with a hypothesis and then you keep trying to test that hypothesis and you refine it as you go. And then there comes a point where you realize that hypothesis is not working anymore. So you come up with a new one. You come up with a new model. That's what we're seeing now. And it's for me, as someone who covers this day in, day out, it's really exciting to actually see this shift happening right before my eyes. So I think it's a very cool time to be studying human origins and learning about them. And I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about in the next year.
And Gemma, I've heard people talk about this in the way we teach and learn science. Maybe we shouldn't be so focused on memorizing the date that we currently think humans did this or that. We should be focusing on the methods and evaluating the evidence and being scientists ourselves instead of learning the science facts that other scientists have passed along.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, whenever you hear, for example, hey, we found a new fossil of a human ancestor and it's 3 million years old, that you should look at that skeptically and look at the research. And, you know, if you can, I always recommend for readers and listeners to go in and read some of these academic papers. Even if you don't have a background in it, you read enough of them, you'll be able to understand them very well, and you'll be able to see for yourself the evidence and weigh that evidence and really kind of think critically about the theories and the hypotheses, because that's really how science advances, by people thinking critically and looking for the model that makes the most sense given the evidence you have.
Gemma, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joined us to look back at a couple of the biggest stories in science in 2017. By the way, we're going to pick up more of the big stories in science coming up next week, Monday after 3:30. First, we don't often get to hear sitting U.S. Supreme Court justices speak because recording equipment is not allowed in the courtroom. But justices are often invited to speak at things like graduations and other events. And Justice Antonin Scalia was very popular on that circuit. He used those opportunities not only to address and develop his theories on the law, but also on topics like faith, friendship, and people he considered heroes.
Justice Scalia died in 2016 at the age of 79. Christopher Scalia is the eighth of Justice Scalia's nine children and received his PhD in English from the UW-Madison. He's a former professor of English who now works at a public relations firm near Washington, D.C., and he recently published a collection of his father's speeches called Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be on.
So in compiling this book, it is broken up into various topics ranging from religious conversations to looking at the Constitution. Your father, Antonin Scalia, Justice Scalia, spoke to a lot of people. What kind of groups was he called upon to speak to?
Well, obviously, the sort of group that most often invited him would have been legal organizations. And he often spoke to legal groups about his approach to the Constitution. But when we put together this collection, my co-editor, Ed Whalen, and I wanted to make sure that it would be enjoyable to not just legal scholars or law students or Supreme Court nerds, but the average American with kind of a basic interest in the law, in American history and government, and maybe my father's life. So we included a lot of speeches that he delivered to organizations like an Italian-American organization, an Irish-American organization, a speech he delivered at a Holocaust remembrance ceremony, and then high school and college commencement addresses are in here. There's a speech he delivered at Juilliard. There's a speech he delivered to a wild turkey hunting club. So it's a really, I knew he delivered a lot of speeches, but I really did not realize the variety of topics he covered in his speeches and the variety of audiences he spoke to.
And, you know, you can see that in some of his speeches that aren't necessarily geared towards maybe the legal profession. I know he did speak about hunting at times and things mm-hmm. like that. Do you think that there might be a misconception sometimes about your father with him being a justice versus him being a person that wants to communicate with other groups sometimes?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Anybody who reads the speeches in Scalia Speaks will find that I think he's a lot more engaging and really open-minded than he's often portrayed, and maybe comes across in some of his opinions. People like reading his dissents, and his opinions are very well written and quotable, but that's a specific type of writing that has to follow particular conventions that aren't really all that accessible for a lot of people. His speeches, as I was saying before, are more accessible to general audience because they don't have to follow that same conventions, but they're also opportunities for him to persuade people directly, kind of unfiltered through opinions and specific cases, to really explain himself and his approaches to jurisprudence and interpreting the Constitution and statutes. I think people will be really surprised by some of what he says about, for example, American identity, just because maybe preconceptions people have about what conservatives in general, but particularly his attitudes would be about American identity. But, you know, his father was an immigrant, and he liked speaking to immigrant groups about, you know, what it meant to be an American. And that one of the first speeches in this collection is about that, about it doesn't matter where you were born. It doesn't matter what your religion is. What matters is that you believe in the American ideals of freedom and opportunity.
It's interesting that we've been talking a little bit about some misconceptions about your father, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. You know, the person who wrote the foreword for the book was his colleague, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I think they have frequently been shown as being sort of the opposite sides of one coin a lot of the times, not always agreeing on things. How does that fold into, I guess, the portrait of him as a person?
Well, he got along with plenty of people who didn't agree with him politically or legally. Justice Ginsburg was absolutely one of his best friends, and they were close friends for a very long time, going back to the early 1980s when they were first judges together. She was gracious enough to write a very moving foreword to this collection, and the collection includes a roast he delivered for her when she was still on a circuit or an appeals court, and he was on the Supreme Court. They weren't colleagues anymore, and they weren't yet colleagues again. But it's a funny roast because he pokes fun at her a little bit. But then at the end of the speech, it's a very moving tribute to what a great friend she was and what a great colleague she was. As far as their working relationship went, they would, as you mentioned, they didn't agree on very much legally, but they would still help each other out with their opinions. And she describes how much she appreciated his feedback, his editorial comments on drafts of her opinions. Even when they disagreed, they helped each other write better opinions. And as far as their friendship went, they had enough in common. They grew up in New York City around the same time. They both loved opera. They even had kind of cameo appearances in operas together. And their spouses got along very well. Her late husband and my mother both loved to cook, and Justice Ginsburg and especially my dad both loved to eat. So they had plenty to bond over apart from their job.
And can you talk a little bit about the quote-unquote outline that he had?
Yeah, so for the most part, he had typed speeches in front of him, prepared remarks that were pretty orderly, and he didn't stick to them verbatim, but he still had a pretty clear guide. I saw him or heard him deliver a speech in Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, in 2001, and it was a great speech. It was a speech he delivered pretty often, actually, and always got a good response, and he kind of used the speech to explain why he interpreted the Constitution as he did and why other methods were inferior. And when I started work on this project, I thought for sure I'd find that speech because he delivered it so often. But it turns out he never wrote that speech down. Instead, he just had something that he called the outline, which was a very fragmented set of notes. There weren't really any complete sentences on it. It wasn't even a full outline. If a student gave me this outline, I would expect a very shabby paper. But it was essentially a series of prompts that inspired certain thoughts in him that he could just riff off of and lead into a very impressive and engaging speech. He didn't really need much with it. But this outline was funny because he had it with him at all times, and apparently his secretary would make dozens of copies for it to always give him when he was off to deliver a speech. Even if the speech wasn't this outline, it was another prepared speech, he always had the outline handy with him just in case.
We're talking to Chris Scalia right now. He is the son of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and recently published a collection of his father's called Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. These are a collection of his speeches. And you were just talking about the speech that he delivered at UW-Madison where he was looking at the Constitution. I believe it had something to do with Prego tomato sauce. How was that received? What was he trying to get at with talking about Prego and, I guess, the Constitution here?
Well, this was another thing that when it was one of my favorite moments in this kind of stump speech he gave, and I thought for sure I'd find it, but he never wrote this down. He liked to kind of deliver it impromptu. But it's a criticism of what's called the living Constitution, and very basically the living Constitution approach to constitutional jurisprudence is that the Constitution is a living document whose meaning changes according to the moral standards of the age. My father's approach is called originalism, which seeks to interpret the Constitution based on its original public meaning at the time of its ratification. And my father's argument about the living Constitution is that it gives too much power to judges to basically apply their own policy preferences into the Constitution, even if the Constitution says nothing about that specific topic. Rather than leaving it up to democratic action, the living Constitution will just have judges determine that meaning, or kind of the phrase legislate from the bench. That's essentially what that applies to. So my father liked to compare the living Constitution approach to a Prego pasta sauce commercial from the 1980s. And I always loved it because I used to watch TV with him in the 80s. So it was just kind of it was funny for me to see him talking about this commercial we watched together. But his argument was in this commercial, a woman is cooking or is heating up tomato sauce and her husband's unhappy that it's not homemade. And he says, "You can't make this store-bought sauce. Does it have the oregano?" And she says, "It's in there." "Okay, but does it have the onion?" "It's in there." What about the garlic?" "It's in there." And my dad would say, "We've got that kind of a constitution now. You want a right to an abortion? It's in there. You want a right to die? It's in there. Anything that's good and true, any policy preference you like, it's in there, regardless of what the document actually says." And I always thought that was a really effective way, very funny, but effective way of explaining some of the problems with the living Constitution approach to jurisprudence, while delivering it to a general audience, an audience that hasn't studied law.
And you say in your book that your father had a bit of a wicked sense of humor, and it sounds as though in this UW-Madison speech, because he was coming to speak here at your commencement, if I'm correct, how did his sense of humor, how did he sometimes shine in the speeches where he was not only a justice and a lawyer, but also a person that got to, I guess, think about these things and sort of ruminate on these issues?
Well, unlike court opinions, my father could let a lot more of his personality come through and his love of performing come through in the speeches. Yeah, he loved to perform. He was, as I say in my introduction to this collection, he was a little bit of a ham. He played the starring role in his high school's performance of Macbeth. And he was the president of Georgetown's theater club, and he loved telling jokes. He's a great joke teller, a great storyteller, and speeches would let those elements of his personality really shine through in a way that opinions couldn't. But he was also, in his speeches, he had this great self-deprecating humor. There's one speech in here in which he describes the games and sports he played growing up as a boy in Queens. And the speech begins something like, "I am often asked, to what do I attribute my athletic prowess?" and of course, nobody ever asked him that, because after all, he spent his career, he made his living by sitting on a bench, not as an athlete. So this book has many moments of great humor like that, often at his own expense.
For people who are picking up this book, what do you hope they learn about him through these speeches?
Well, I hope that they learn more about his approach to the law, and it why he held the legal opinions he did. But I think that they're also going to learn a lot more about what he was like as a person, you know, what values he held and why he loved America as much as he did, what he admired about the different people that make up the American body politic and American history.
And your father died last year in February. What was it like for you to revisit your father's words in the year following his death?
It was cathartic because, well, it was a lot of fun, and it was cathartic because his voice is so strong in these speeches. I really did feel often as if he was actually in the room with me delivering these speeches and saying these things to me. It was, you know, it was a privilege to be a part of this project and to get these speeches out to a broad audience, but it was also just kind of a very moving experience having this, you know, connection again with him.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Christopher Scalia is the son of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He recently edited and published a collection of his father's speeches called Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. With Hanukkah starting tomorrow and Christmas and New Year's right around the corner, it's a busy time and a time that many of us want to spend with friends and family.
But there are a lot of folks who will work right through the holidays or only be able to take a little bit of time off.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you going to be working on a holiday that is meaningful to you or your family? Is that because it's a job that needs to be done regardless of the day, or do you choose to work because you get paid more, or you get to celebrate, or you get something else in return, or it's just not a holiday that you celebrate anyway?
If someone in your family works on holidays, how do you manage to celebrate despite the scheduling challenges? Any tips or advice to share? Call 800-642-1234. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Now, a recent staffing survey showed that nationally, almost 1 in 5 workers will work the entire week between Christmas and New Year's. About 2/3 will take some time off during that week, but 2/3 of them will be checking in on work even though they're technically off, which is a really interesting way to think of how work works these days.
We heard from a lot of people, by the way, on Facebook. Teresa writes, I'll be working the 21st through 24th on an ambulance. I scheduled myself for those days. However, once I get onto the rotating schedule, I will gladly cover for people who'd like to be off with their family and kids. And yeah, I think about, you know, medical people who work in medicine,
yeah,
emergency services. You can't have everybody take
sure,
the day off
yeah.
on a holiday. I had, actually growing up, I had an uncle who was a nurse in a psychiatric care facility, and yeah,
you have
somebody
to
had to be on shift, so he would miss Christmas Eve.
Well, there was that story about airlines recently that,
oh, right,
through some glitch in their software, basically gave every pilot the day off, which is generally a big no-no on Christmas, as people who do celebrate want to travel and get to their families during that time.
They could have just had the passengers step up and take turns flying,
yeah, just
right?
Like
it
a
works
flying co-op. I mean, autopilot.
Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Are you working the holidays? What is that like? Is it because you have to or you choose to? Linda is with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
When I was growing up, my mom worked nights as a nurse's aide because you made more money on night shift, and you also made more money night shift holidays. So the holiday was when we all sat down and celebrated together, not necessarily a day on the calendar.
So you made your own Christmas day, basically.
Yes.
Linda, fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. And I see that happening. It seems like it happens more and more with families where you celebrate Christmas because people are traveling. You
sure.
live in different states. One side of my family does it in Michigan about a week and a half before Christmas,
yeah,
most years. Some people wait until after New Year's.
I do think that that's something that my family and I are going to be doing this year, where just because I actually do have to work the day after Christmas, I guess Boxing Day, depending on who you're talking to, I will be back, and my family has been pretty flexible in saying, yeah, we can celebrate a couple days early, so you don't have to be traveling back super late before you have to go to work. So I will be here, everyone, so hello in advance.
Thanks for that call, Linda, at 800-642-1234. We heard from Clarence in Watertown. He called in, couldn't stay on the line, maybe because of his job as a dairy farmer. He works weekends and every holiday. Makes sense. He offers time and a half pay for those employees who work with him on holidays, and they plan their celebrations around the work they do. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Clarence.
Yeah, and now we're going to go back to our callers. Brian in Waukesha. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
So what are your, I guess, your holiday working plans?
Exactly that, working over the holiday. Don't have the luxury to not work.
What kind of work do you do, Brian?
I do seasonal roofing and siding, and do a bit of carpentry inside, finish and drywall, but there's wasn't a lot set up for the winter work here, and the summer work was going longer than expected, and it was great, but now it's the cold, so it's all inside work whenever you can get it.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for that call, and I do think that you hear a lot about that, that some people do have these seasonal jobs that are pretty reliant on, you know, the weather versus just the time or the calendar.
And you take the work when you get it, yeah.
Absolutely. Let's take one more call. We have Lenny in Madison. Hi, Lenny.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. What do you have to say?
I have to say that I do prefer working the holidays. I do work in the health system. I find it very beneficially to work Christmas due to I have a lot of coworkers that do have family, kids, and I find it very important for them to spend time with them. I don't have any kids, so I do find beneficially to work the holidays. Plus, it is time and a half, so that works out great for me. And as long as I have Thanksgiving off, I'm very grateful for that.
Sure. So it sounds like you have a little bit of flexibility by saying, hey, I want Thanksgiving off, but I'm more than happy to cover for my friends or my coworkers around this time of the year. Well, thank you so much for that call, Lenny.
I think we have time for one more. Gail with us in Stillwater. Gail, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Gail?
Well, I'm a nurse and I work every other holiday. And I've been doing this for 35 years. And like the first lady said, your holiday is just when your family is there. And it can be at 9 in the morning. It can be at 9 in the evening. And as long as you've got family and food, it's wonderful.
Gail, thank you so much for sharing that story. And thank you so much for the work that you do. We appreciate it. Thanks for all your calls. You can share your story still. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you work through the holidays, why you work, and how you manage the family time around that. I'll be working through around the holidays here, but I'll get some time with my family over New Year's.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And you've got plans to, you've got a wedding, though.
I have a wedding this weekend that I'm going to, so I get to have my holiday just a little bit early.
Again, share your stories, the Ideas Network Facebook page. How would you represent Wisconsin? Wait, using only the sense of smell. Some candle companies are trying to answer that very question.
As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a national company makes homesick candles for each state. According to the company, the Wisconsin scent includes all the ingredients for a perfect cinnamon kringle on a snowy afternoon.
So it's got smells like peppermint, cranberry, maple, butter, cream, and I would assume cinnamon in there somewhere.
Maybe some cinnamon. We won't necessarily tread into that territory. And the Milwaukee Candle Company makes locally themed smells, including Brandy Old Fashioned, which...
I think I would buy that candle, actually.
Yeah, it would probably smell really good. They also had the beach smell. I'm now blanking on
the beach in Milwaukee,
which, I mean, maybe because I like the smell of sunscreen, which is apparently one of the scents. I was like, oh, that would be nice.
And there's also a brewery tour.
Yeah,
which makes us say the word brewery.
Brewery.
Yeah. A beer smell. I mean, do we need a candle to generate the smell of beer in Wisconsin?
I don't know. Maybe if you're feeling really nostalgic, maybe if you are maybe a Wisconsin expat living maybe in another state, you might want that evocative smell.
You could just buy the beer. if that's the case. Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. What smell would you associate with Wisconsin? Especially if you moved away, what would you want to recapture? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.